Hi, I'm Kara O'Keefe.
And I'm Susie Rigdon. You're listening to the Fall for the Book podcast, part of Watershed Lit. We're celebrating 23 years of the Fall for the Book Festival by sitting down with writers across the genre spectrum. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to visit fallforthebook.org to find out more about our virtual festival. So, Kara, today we are talking with two incredible writers, Sandra Beasley, author of the poetry collection Made to Explode, and Chris Stuck, author of the short story collection, Give My Love to the Savages. And one thing I know that we're going to be chatting with them about is how to write really strong moments of emotional intensity, how to write violence, how to get into kind of these deep waters. And, you know, since we both teach literature, I wanted to ask about how do you approach teaching this type of writing with your students?
I think this is such an interesting question because so often it's one of the harder things for students to figure out is like how to talk about something like that in a work of fiction. And there's a particular story I use very frequently when I'm talking about this. And it's a story called Among the Wreckage. It's from Paul Yoon's collection, Once the Shore. And one of the things I love about it is that the moments of the most violence and the most emotional intensity are always very understated. And they're punctuated with these incredibly specific details that almost just like allow the facts of what happened in that moment to speak for themselves. And they're so resonant and it works so, so well. And it's always a bit of, it's an interesting thing for I think first time writers and students studying literature to navigate, figuring out that it's the moments that feel big emotionally are not always punctuated with several exclamation points or anything like that.
I agree with you fully that some of the pieces that hit me the most strongly are these stripped back bare pieces or the pieces that are focused kind of on the negative space of the situation. You know, some of the pieces that I used to love to teach when I was teaching intro lit was Refresh, Refresh by Benjamin Percy. And even though it's on the longer side for a short story, it's a very stark story. I mean, it just opens up with these two boys bare knuckle boxing in the backyard, and the whole story is like that. And it's so emotionally heavy, but the language is not, it's not weighed down. The example that I always like to use that is perhaps, I don't know if that dates me or puts me in a category, but I love Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the episode that gets me the most is The Body. And I won't go into all the details in case you haven't seen it yet. But in that episode, these moments of great grief are framed in the negative space. So when somebody is finding out about this huge moment, you don't hear what's going on. You see it through a pane of glass. You're watching everything else, but you focus on them. And I think for me, that's much more powerful than, you know, the Grey's Anatomy effect with the sweeping music and those exclamation points that you're talking about.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of like trust in the viewer or the reader that those moments have, because it doesn't need the sweeping music to explain to you how you're supposed to be feeling. As long as like those particular details or that negative space is sort of framed in the right way, it becomes clear. And I think that works so well. I actually used to teach Refresh, Refresh too. I teach it quite a lot. And the other thing about you know, some of those like boxing scenes is I feel like it does such a good job of getting at some of the complexity underneath those moments that feel very violent, like that, you know, you've got like the bare knuckle boxing between these two boys, but they're boys that are close friends and care about each other so much. And there are so many moments that, you know, are kind of marked by these moments of violence and fighting between the two of them, but that you can also see like the very intense love that they have for each other. And the significance of this friendship that they have that come through in, you know, ironically, these moments where they're fighting each other. And I think it's really fascinating how those moments get depicted in a short story or in a poem. I'm really excited to talk about some of these things with both Sandra and Chris today, because they both do have some of those same very like emotionally resonant moments that happen in both Sandra's poems and Chris's stories. We're so excited to be talking today with Sandra Beasley and Chris Stuck. Sandra Beasley is the author of four poetry collections, Made to Explode, Count the Waves, I Was the Jukebox, and Theories of Falling, as well as Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, Tales from an Allergic Life, a disability memoir and cultural history of food allergies. Chris Stuck is the author of the short story collection, Give My Love to the Savages. He's a freelance writer and editor living in Portland, Oregon, and earned an MFA in fiction from George Mason University. Welcome, Sandra and Chris. We're excited to be talking with you today.
Thanks so much.
So I wanted to start by asking both of you where you're from and where you're living now, because I feel like that influences a lot of both of your writing.
Sure. I grew up in, my very first home was in Arlington, Virginia. And then my family still lives in Northern Virginia in Vienna. I came into what I would say city proper for my MFA at American University, lived in DuPont Circle, kind of had a series of addresses in Northwest, and have now found a neighborhood in Southwest Washington, D.C., which really feels right for me down by the waterfront. So in terms of kind of irrelevance to my work, I'm right near the National Mall. I definitely feel the imprint of things when they're happening, for better or for worse, on a national scale. And I'm constantly thinking about this being both the capital, but also just a town and a city that I love a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Chris?
It's pretty similar. I was born in Washington, D.C. I grew up in Falls Church, Virginia. My mother's from Virginia. My dad is from Washington State. So in the mid-80s, we moved out to Washington State near Seattle for like 4 or 5 years. And then my parents were both government workers, so the economy wasn't as good out this way. So we went back, and they went back to working for the government. And I lived in Arlington, Alexandria, Falls Church again. I lived in, eventually we settled out in Fairfax County in Burke, Virginia. And that's where I went to high school. And I went to George Mason for my undergraduate. Immediately after that, I went to graduate school at George Mason, and then got some fellowships, moved around a little bit, and back and forth to Massachusetts a couple times. But Virginia was always sort of my home base. And then eventually in 2007, I just decided to go west, and I've been in Portland ever since.
You know, as Kara mentioned, place seems to hold a center kind of position in a lot of your work. And a lot of that is focused around the violence of a place. So Sandra, I'm thinking of the Sniper Dance and Nostalgia or Black Death Spectacle. And of course, Chris, Give My Love to the Savages. Can you both talk a little bit about how you write about such landmark moments for DC, Virginia, for LA, and how they've kind of influenced your own experience of these locations?
That's a hard one. I think, with the LA uprising, LA riots, that was such, I'm 45, so I remember how I saw how it all unfurled, I guess, you know, originally seeing Rodney King, the videotape of him being beaten. And then you see all this stuff just, you know, gather. And actually with LA, I don't really, that took a lot of research. Like plus it was something from way far back in history that I wasn't there for. So I had to do a lot of fiction writing with that. I think that particular moment I was drawn to because basically a friend of mine told me a story of their cousin flew into LA right when the LA riots were starting. And as soon as I heard that story, I knew I was going to write it as a story. And I actually asked her, we were at a writing residency, and I asked her not to tell anybody that story just so I could have it. But I think it just, I just saw the race and identity has always been around me. My mother's Black, my father's white. So like, but I grew up in a predominantly Black family. So all that stuff's always been around. So I knew it was the exact story I was actually looking for at one time.
Sandra, how about you?
Yeah, I think one thing for me is that with this book in particular, I wasn't just engaging my own sense of things. I was trying to think about my grandparents' generation. And, you know, I had one set of grandparents who had a home in McLean, another who had a home in Seven Corners. So part of it is that when I think about my relationship to things in this area, it spans really a number of years. I always freeze up. I want to be clear that, you know, when a poem is called something like The Sniper Dance, that's a kind of purposefully ironic glibness. You know, it's not that I don't don't take that violence really seriously. What I remember was I had not that long before moved back. And at that point, I was still living with my folks in Virginia. So going across Chain Bridge, and people were not moving or processing their lives the way they normally did. I mean, I think people forget, like, people were trying to go as long as they could without grocery shopping, without filling the car tank with gas. I mean, and actually part of the inspiration for that poem was being at the gas station. I was about to run out of gas to get to my classes at American, and seeing a white van parked around the corner and just panicking, like not even closing the gas cap. Like I had a CD on the stuff on the roof of the car that flew off as I drove away. And when I mentioned it to my parents later, they were like, why did you get gas? I mean, it was just an incredibly intense time. So it's interesting that the book captures those moments that are highly pressurized, very specific. And then also these kind of larger patterns of relationships to the area through the lens of going back to my grandparents' generation.
I think it's really interesting how you have to kind of navigate this tension between a place that in some ways is kind of marked by violence in much the way that people felt in DC during the sniper, but it's also a place that contains all of these like regular routines of daily life. How do you kind of think about that when you're writing a poem or a story about a place that is kind of like marked by violence, but it's also this place you know as your home or you know as a part of your regular life?
I don't want to overemphasize. It's not as if I felt like I was at some constant nexus of danger, but maybe to step a little bit lateral to that. You know, I mean, I have a lot of poems in the book about monuments and memorials. And I thought a lot even before, I mean, these were poems that I was already engaged with before some of the, like what happened in Charlottesville. I mean, I went to University of Virginia, I lived on the lawn. So the sight of seeing people gathered on the lawn in Charlottesville with tiki torches, like that really, there's no poem about that, but it really electrified my engagement with this project. And so just kind of casually understanding that an intersection might one day be where someone's playing music and another day, it like in January of, you know, this year, like might be a place where you see armed guards. So in that sense, yeah, the toggling between the everyday and the kind of highly, highly politicized is something that I'm very aware of living in this area.
Chris, what about you? You talked about growing up near DC, so you might have some of the same experiences, but you've also been on the West Coast for quite a while. So I don't know if there are like different places that you can kind of see where some of those things have come together, either in your work or in any particular short story.
Yeah, I mean, with the title story, I mean, the first story is also about, you know, sort of psychological violence of, you know, I grew up in the 80s and Virginia, and there are certain words I was called back then that you thought would go away, and they kind of did for a while, and then now they're coming back. I mean, with the title story with LA, the riots or the uprising, I definitely wanted to explore, you know, you saw a lot of images of it back then, and nowadays it's easy to see, to put yourself in those situations because you see everything on the internet or social media. But that one was so far back, and a lot of people are pretty interested in the fact that I wrote about that because it's almost, it's not buried in history, but so much has happened since then that, but I also think that was like, for me, since, I don't know, I feel like I'm an old man, like I can start to see, I'm at the age where I can start to see repetition in these things. And like, you know, younger people might be, especially with George Floyd, not as be very surprised that this stuff has happened, but like, it's like talking to my parents, they thought, you know, with Trump, they felt the same way about Nixon, you know what I mean? So like, you start to see the repetition and I don't know, I guess that's just something I'm interested in.
So Kara and I started off this podcast talking about how we teach our students how to step away from melodrama when you're writing moments of emotional intensity or violence. So we've noticed that in your writing, you approach this quite differently. So Sandra, I was wondering if you could start us off, talk a little bit about how you approach writing these intense moments.
So one poem that was mentioned earlier was a poem that goes by the title of Black Death Spectacle, and that's a golden shovel. So it's actually drawing on Gwendolyn Brooks' poem about the death of Emmett Till. And I just want to say that because Made to Explode as a whole has a fair number of poems that deal with the kind of racial and cultural inheritances of being in the Virginia, DC area, which means it is dealing with race, I had to think about one thing I felt really strongly about was I felt like I was going to write poems that needed to acknowledge or situate Black pain as part of the narrative, but I did not want to attach aesthetic language to that pain, meaning I, as a white writer, did not want to spend my energy on metaphors and similes and images, or like, I just didn't think it was my place. So I tried wherever appropriate to kind of acknowledge it as succinctly as I could for the necessity of the narrative. But then if I was going to have imagery in that poem, build that imagery kind of elsewhere, if that makes sense. And it's really worth noting because that in the Black Death Spectacle poem, the painting that was at the Biennale that's critiquing it did not do that. That painting leaned in, building an aesthetic around the face of the corpse of Emmett Till. And I just, that's where I kind of part ways with feeling good about that as a artistic project. And so that I very much thought about violence as a necessity to some of the narratives that I needed to share, but I did not want that to be where my artistry hung out, if that makes sense, where my creativity and my creative energy felt honored.
Absolutely. And Chris, how about you?
I tend to just try it. I mean, it's different for fiction writing. So I tend to just try to fully imagine everything and try not to try to find a different, you know, different images, different ways into those kind of scenes instead of just relying on what people have already seen before. Most of the time with writing, I'm just trying to convey information. I'm not really a flowery kind of writer. I'm not good at that kind of stuff. I'm pretty straightforward. But if I can, like, as far as sentences, but if I can come at it with imagery that's at a different angle than maybe what you've seen, because, like, especially if I'm writing about the LA riots, like, a lot of people have seen imagery about, you know, if I just, like, describe something you've already seen, then it's not as interesting, you know, it's not new. So I'm just trying to make it new every time.
I wanted to ask both of you too about approaching identity in your work. Like Chris, with so many of the stories in the collection, you're dealing with the intersections of racial identity and as well as masculinity. Those are kind of major forces in the collection. Of course, there's the first story you mentioned where you're kind of cataloging somebody's life through all of these moments where he's called a racial slur. You've got a character like Melvin Plump, who's navigating racial identity in a really complicated way. And of course, we talked a little bit about like Junie in the title story as well. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you're approaching those issues of identity when you're writing.
Well, like I said, being Black, biracial, I always wanted to, I guess, explore those things. It took a while to really get to know myself enough to be able to explore them and sort of harness my imagination. So basically, I guess I've been lucky in some ways by certain ideas just come to me, or I'm presented with a situation that makes my mind go off and create some sort of story or scene. And most of the time I've just tried to explore something in a new way. I'm just trying to entertain myself basically and create a puzzle for myself. It's like when I was a kid, I used to like to doodle a lot, you know, I would just like draw pictures, you know, like a lot of kids, but it's just something that I just did. So like, that's kind of what writing is. But I think also reading other writers who were doing that way before me and then seeing what they did and seeing if I could make something new, but maybe along the same lines. And then also I've been lucky enough to grow up in a family that's pretty like my father's. I've grew up around my father's family. I grew up around my mother's family. I have three older brothers from my mother's first marriage that who are Black. So I could see all these different ways that people are dealing with identity or race. And it's just something that's always just it been in me.
I really like the idea of writing to entertain yourself and how that's kind of like where it always starts. And then of course, yeah, all of these other things just kind of naturally come into it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people talk about audience and, you know, I mean, there is audience, but I do think about the reader, of course. And every time I'm writing something, I think of it as a performance. But at the same time, when I'm making it, it's just, I'm just trying to please me and come up with something that I've never seen before. So.
And we're gonna ask you about your Kafka-esque story.
Oh, right.
As soon as you're talking about that, I'm like, yes, of course, that's the one.
Right.
But Sandra, yeah, in your work, you know, you've already talked about a lot of considerations that you have worked with on writing your own identity, the identity of your family, grief, historical trauma, those kinds of things. And I'm wondering, how did all of these considerations tie into you writing the poem called Intersectionality?
Well, that's a disability poem. And it, you know, I have been writing about my food allergies, which are multiple and life-threatening and fairly pervasive. I've been writing about that since my first book, but the way that I've written about it has changed. And it kind of went from narratives drawn from childhood, kind of trauma narratives of young adulthood, how what it's like when food, which is so often used to include people, in my case was being used to kind of set me apart. And then I wrote Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, which really blended in a lot of science, a lot of research, a lot of medicine, you know, really going for a cultural history. And then now at this point, I'm writing about food allergies more from an understanding of affiliating with the disability community and thinking about those politics, thinking about a social justice model where we're really questioning, is the issue us? Or is the issue the society that's not choosing to accommodate and include us? So I, you know, intersectionality is a thorny poem. I am very aware that in disability advocacy, it's too white. It's too much white women specifically. And as someone who came late to this identity, the last thing I want to do is kind of take up space that needs to be available to others. At the same time, what I wanted to examine was this really funny dynamic that I had over and over again, where people were coming to me, parents were coming to me, proud to talk to me about food allergies and how food allergies figured into their family story, and then immediately giving me tons of detail about all of their efforts to cure their children, and really needing and wanting for me to validate this narrative. And I don't think I need to be cured. If you offered me a cure for my food allergies today, I would not take it. So it was me trying to kind of process this issue where there's solidarity up to a point, but then the solidarity yields to some other set of imperatives. And just in my desperate effort to try to figure out a framing metaphor for a very weird power dynamic, I thought back to the fact that when I was in high school, I was incapable of learning. I could never pass the rule about who had right of way at a four-way intersection. And it's because my mind always went straight to the imagined perfect scenario of everyone arriving on their respective corner at the exact same time. And because I couldn't process it under those circumstances, I couldn't process it at all. And for some reason, that understanding of right away in that like highly rarefied situation kind of helped me leap back to thinking about right of way in advocacy world and in disability world.
So I want to jump back really quick and go back to something Susie mentioned about writing things that are taboo or feel like risky and asking you to kind of, you know, or asking yourself as a writer to kind of push the envelope a little bit. Chris, you know, you have one of the stories Susie mentioned called How to Be a Dick in the 21st Century, which is definitely feels like it's tackling a big taboo. There's another story in the collection where you've got a man who kind of almost accidentally comes into this polyamorous relationship that he's not expecting, and I feel like that's kind of dealing with taboo too. So I'm curious how you both approach these taboos or these moments that you feel like you're really kind of having to like take a big risk with your writing.
With that kind of stuff, I guess I just jump all the way in. I'm interested in risky things. I'm interested in stuff that has edge, and I actually look for it because I want to see that more in writing, I guess, and especially mine. Exploring it, I guess, is more actually writing it is, you know, that's where it gets hard. And I obviously have all kinds of self-doubt throughout all that stuff. The story you're talking about, Lake No Negro, about the polyamorous, that's another thing where you just happen to find out stuff when you, like, I moved to Portland, found out there's this town called Lake Oswego in the suburbs that a lot of the towns, you know, a lot of places have nicknames, so they cut, and it's a very white place. And I guess at one point they had like sunset laws. And there was an idea like, you know, Black people weren't allowed there. So it was called Lake No Negro. As soon as I heard that, I'm like, I'm writing a story called Lake No Negro. And a lot of times when I'm writing stuff like this, I'm thinking about multiple things. So I found out there are a lot of polyamorous relationships in Portland for some reason. I don't know why. And then I found out the Lake No Negro thing. I had a friend who kind of got into it had some relationship with a married woman, and the husband was okay with it. This is back in Virginia. So then I just combined things, and then hopefully it works out. But as far as, and I think so is just being bold. And it's hearing Sandra talk about her work, it sounds like it's bold and it's in its way, you know? And I think that's what it's all about for me is just I'm into bold work. I want my work to be bold. And in order to do that, you kind of have to write about some crazy stuff, you know what I mean? Or interesting stuff. Yeah, so.
Well, part of what I love hearing, Chris, when you talk about your work, I mean, I think it's doing, well, first off, now I'm in awe of your titles, but but also I just love that it's that intrinsic understanding that really interesting works of art, they can't just find a nerve and press on it. They have to do like another thing. There has to be some other texture or unexpected thing for it to react to. One poem that I hardly ever talk about is called Self-Portrait of George Catlin. And the epigraph is gives a just a layman's definition of the word generic-y. And that's not a word I had heard used until the last 5 years or so, but it's a word that's relevant to me because like a lot of folks of a certain era and a certain ethnicity and a certain geography, I still have, but the distant family relative who, depending on which story, was either Navajo or Cherokee. And I carried forward that smidgen of identity. I became very aware of it when the controversies around Elizabeth Warren erupted and really kind of questioned this romanticized one ancestor. And I'm not saying anyone did it out of malevolence, but what hearing the word generic-y helped me understand is that it's an act of erasure. It's an act of a group of people thinking that they can somehow represent a tradition, but they have no legitimate relation to inheritance to, you know, because they have that one ancestral claim. And that really got to me, but I couldn't write a poem about just that. And then I thought, well, having grown up in this area, one of the more notable artistic displays is the Catlin collection of paintings of what he would have called American Indians. And I thought, well, I could kind of look at that a little bit, because that was something that, because of where I live physically in the city, I saw more than once, never felt comfortable around it, always kind of didn't know what to do with that. And then I was like, but even that's not enough, because that's too easy. And I asked my husband, who's a painter and will hate that I'm mentioning on him on this podcast, but I said, what would you, if I just showed you a single Catlin, what would you say? And he said, well, honestly, as a painter, I tell you that it's beautiful. Like, most of them are really, really gorgeously executed. And that gave me the friction, what I needed. And I still don't love those paintings, but being able to kind of understand the personal tie, the artist whose life work I could kind of interrogate, and getting the particular nudge to look at the paintings, to look at how they were coded in the Smithsonian catalogs, to understand that to some people they really are luminous works in terms of color and line. And, you know, that, I mean, you got to have all that stuff going on. Otherwise, it's someone just standing on a soapbox preaching to a choir, you know, and that's where it gets interesting, is in those difficult parts.
I love how this idea of like layering in or kind of adding in unexpected like storylines or different elements ends up kind of complicating those taboos so much and ultimately making for something much more interesting. That's really good.
So our final question for you both, a very different tack than the rest and maybe a little bit more straightforward. Which writers are inspiring you right now?
I'm trying to not get up and physically walk around the space because I'm in my office. So it's very hard to answer that question always without wanting to walk over and look at your bookshelves.
Exactly. Oh man, I'm looking at my bookshelf now.
I mean, let me very quickly say on a nonfiction front, because I have recommended over and over Kathy Park Hong's Minor Feelings, and I'm super enamored with Alyssa Washuda's White Magic. So those are two essay collections that have come out that I really love. That is not to short shrift poetry. It's more just like I'm flooded with poetry titles. So let me just start with that.
Yeah. Another George Mason alum is Rion Amilcar Scott. He's dope. Nafisa Thompson Spires. I've been in like short story mode for a long time, so I'm probably going to mention all short story writers, but those two, I feel like we're kind of all doing something similar. So I look to them for inspiration.
Well, thank you guys both for joining us today. It's been really great talking with both of you about these books, and congratulations again on them.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
The Fall for the Book podcast is produced by Susie Rigdon as a part of Watershed Lit. For more episodes, you can follow us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify. Fall for the Book is a nonprofit literary arts organization, and you can find more information about our programs and events at fallforthebook.org. Read on.